Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents We March Against England, Operation Sea Lion, 1940-1941, by Robert Forchick, narrated by Paul Bamer. Introduction. After winning a stunning victory in France in June 1940, Adolf Hitler issued Führer Directive No. 16, which initiated preparations for a potential invasion of England, designated as Unternehmen Seelöwe, Operation Sea Lion. Consequently, the German Kriegsmarine, Navy, and Heer, Army, began improvising an invasion fleet, initially by gathering large numbers of river barges and small motor vessels and assembling them in the occupied channel ports. Regarding air superiority as a sine qua non to ensure the success of any amphibious operation, Hitler ordered the Luftwaffe to crush the Royal Air Force, RAF, and obtain air superiority over the English Channel. Yet, despite 2 months of intensive air operations in August to September 1940, the Luftwaffe could not defeat the RAF, and Hitler became uneasy about the Kriegsmarine's ability to conduct Seelöwe without adequate air cover. Furthermore, the RAF began bombing the invasion barges in the Channel ports, inflicting considerable damage. Unnerved by the prospect of failure, on the 17th of September, Hitler decided to postpone Seelöwe. By standing firm against the Luftwaffe, the few of RAF Fighter Command frustrated Hitler's plans to invade England and thereby inflicted the first major defeat upon the Third Reich. In short, this is the standard orthodoxy about Operation Sea Lion and the Battle of Britain. England saved as a result of the RAF winning a 2-month air battle, and the Third Reich chastised by its first strategic defeat. This heroic orthodoxy was promoted first by Winston Churchill and British wartime propaganda, then in the official post-war histories. The 15th of September was officially made a day to commemorate the Battle of Britain and, implicitly, the day the battle was decided. The British film The Battle of Britain, 1969, reaffirmed this thesis for the general public by promoting the notion that the German threat to England essentially ended after the climactic air battles on the 15th of September, 1940. In a memorable scene at the film's conclusion, ostensibly depicting the day after, RAF fighter pilots are shown sitting in lawn chairs for raids that no longer come, while, over in France, German soldiers are shown throwing their life preservers into a huge pile, representing the cancellation of Sea Lion. Some modern historians, such as John Keegan, have continued to endorse the heroic orthodoxy. Keegan stated that, by defeating the Luftwaffe over England, Great Britain remained in the war, and this outcome determined the downfall of Hitler's Germany. Leo McKinstry, another adherent of the orthodox theory, absurdly concluded that the deterrence of Operation Sea Lion was the beginning of the end for the Reich. As if to add insult to injury, the standard orthodoxy usually includes some mention that Hitler was never really serious about invading England, and that Sea Lion was something of a Potemkin village-type fraud. Former members of the Luftwaffe, such as fighter ace Adolf Galland and Generalfeldmarschall Albert Kesselring, are particularly dismissive of Sea Lion and have been used to lend credence to the idea that the invasion preparations were nothing more than a bluff intended to intimidate Great Britain into considering a negotiated peace. Although Sea Lion remains an item of historical curiosity in Britain, British historians have generally treated Sea Lion with contempt and in absolutist terms. Peter Fleming stated that Operation Sea Lion, as planned and mounted, was doomed to failure and, had it been launched, could only have ended in disaster. Ergo, the threat of invasion was never really a threat. Yet, the standard orthodoxy has been under attack since the 1950s, particularly on the active role played by Fighter Command versus the deterrent role played by the Royal Navy. Hubert R. Allen, one of the few, and author of Who Won the Battle of Britain, 1976, was one of the first to openly criticize the RAF's performance in the campaign. Newer accounts of the Battle of Britain, such as Derek Robinson's Invasion 1940, 2005, and Anthony J. Cummings' The Royal Navy and the Battle of Britain, 2010, have tried to acknowledge that Hitler's fear of the Royal Navy played an equally important role in frustrating Operation Sea Lion, but still tend to fall into the trap of evaluating events in an overly narrow and deterministic context. Max Hastings noted that Britain might have defied the Luftwaffe in September 1940, but this did not advance the goal of defeating the Third Reich, which was accurate, but really only an admission of the obvious. While the question, who won the Battle of Britain, has merit, it has always seemed to me an attempt to divert attention away from the unpleasant fact that Great Britain's military position remained extremely perilous long after the so-called Battle of Britain. Despite what happened in the skies over England in mid-September 1940, Great Britain's military situation was far more precarious than Germany's for another 2 years. The defeat of the Luftwaffe's large-scale daylight raids over Great Britain only curtailed one aspect of the Third Reich's capabilities, but had negligible impact upon Germany's overall ability to inflict pain upon Britain and its people. The mythology of the Battle of Britain and the few conveniently avoided mentioning that Fighter Command was virtually impotent to stop the Luftwaffe's night raids during the Blitz, which killed another 14,715 civilians in the next 3 months, or to prevent German long-range FW-200 Condors from mauling convoys west of Ireland. Nor could the few do anything to prevent U-boats or surface raiders from savaging British convoys during 1940 to 1941. Curiously, the Blitz receives far less attention in English-language historiography than the Battle of Britain, even though it lasted three times as long. While it is true that the presence of the Home Fleet did help to deter Hitler from attempting an invasion in 1940, it was also relatively impotent to prevent the growing menace of U-boat Wolfpack attacks on convoys or disguised commerce raiders, Hilfskreuzer, from threatening British trade in the Atlantic, Indian, and Pacific Oceans. Even the more clever analyses, such as Stephen Bungay's The Most Dangerous Enemy, 2001, remain entrenched in parochial interpretations that deny a priori, that is, before examining alternative analysis, that Germany had any chance of achieving its objectives against Great Britain. Claims of victory in the skies over England notwithstanding, Fighter Command's efforts did not deprive Hitler of the overall strategic initiative any more than the Royal Navy did. When all was said and done, at the end of September 1940, Hitler decided what was going to come next, not Churchill. Hitler had allies. Churchill had refugees. Without powerful allies or significant offensive capabilities, Great Britain had no potential for achieving its war aims on its own, whereas Hitler had multiple options to try to pressure Great Britain into a negotiated peace. Despite the RAF's impressive defense of Britain's airspace, Hitler still held the strategic initiative going into 1941, not Churchill. Another troubling aspect of the standard orthodoxy about this period is the manner in which many post-war historians have segregated the Battle of Britain, the Blitz, and the Battle of the Atlantic into discrete and non-contiguous boxes, which is rather bizarre, given that these were concurrent campaigns and were all part of Hitler's effort to force Great Britain to submit to a negotiated peace. From the point of view of Führer Directives Numbers 9, 16, and 17, these actions were all part of the same campaign. As an example of this kind of historical de-linking, most standard histories count Luftwaffe bomber losses over Britain in 1940, but ignore British bomber losses over Germany and occupied France, occurring during the same period. The fact that both the British and German strategic bombing offensives and other air-sea actions were involved in the kind of action-reaction cycle characteristic of schismogenesis, where the action of one actor drives the actions of the other, has been ignored because of this artificial compartmentalization scheme. Rather than the iconic BF-109 versus Spitfire model, Great Britain was in fact being assailed by everything from U-boats and disguised merchant raiders to precision night bombing and delayed action bombs. Britain's ability to withstand this ferocious onslaught, which stressed the nation's defenses to their limits, was due to the active efforts of the many, that is, the scientists, the photo interpreters, the WAFs, the merchant seamen, and many others. The problem for historiography has been that the truth of Britain's salvation in the World War II has been too eclectic to fit well into narratives written primarily for general audiences. Tales of Spitfire aces sold books, but the other details were too obscure. There have been many books about Sea Lion. Why another? My approach is intended to be different from previous histories that deal with Operation Sea Lion and the Battle of Britain, because it will holistically link a number of intrinsically related and concurrent activities into a coherent narrative and analysis, not as separate subjects. I also intend to demonstrate that Germany's efforts to coerce Britain to accept a ceasefire involved not just a simplistic daylight duel between fighters for air superiority, but a much larger air and sea campaign, as well as diplomatic efforts, which did not end in September 1940. During the period July 1940 to May 1941, Germany conducted three major interrelated campaigns intended to apply increasing pressure upon Britain. 1. An air-sea campaign against British commerce, involving U-boats, surface raiders, Hilfskreuze, mines, long-range bombers, and S-boats. 2. A terror campaign against the British civilian population, involving precision night bombing and a new type of delayed action bombs. 3. Invasion preparations for an amphibious landing to be conducted in either September 1940 or May 1941. In addition to artificial compartmentalization, most previous works addressing Sea Lion have lacked balance and critical military analysis. Most books on this subject have been written either primarily from the British viewpoint or the German viewpoint, with little effort to integrate actions and intentions. Information about the inadequacies of British defenses has been glossed over. Topics such as the possible British use of chemical weapons to stop the invasion have been uncritically accepted at face value. Furthermore, I intend to demolish the long-cherished notion that the preparations for Sea Lion were a waste of time and resources for the Third Reich. In fact, the amphibious capabilities developed for the invasion of England proved to be of vital importance to sustaining the German war effort in 1942 to 1945 and contributed to several later Allied defeats. Sea Lion was not a chimera. As part of lending balance to the historical scales, I intend to demonstrate that the British made their share of mistakes and labored under misconceptions, just as the Germans did. While the German wartime leadership involved in planning Seelöwe has often been accused of substituting fantasy for reality, post-war British discussions of Operation Sea Lion have also been permeated by several recurring fantasies. Three, in particular, are intrinsic to the British dismissal of Sea Lion. 1. The idea that the Royal Navy would easily intercept German invasion convoys in mid-channel and destroy the bulk of them in a massive turkey shoot type scenario. 2. The idea that the Royal Navy could easily sever the sea lines of communications of any residual German landing force, causing that force to surrender within a matter of days. 3. The idea that the British Army could have contained, then quickly eliminated, any German beachheads. The famous war game on Sea Lion, conducted at Sandhurst in 1974, concluded that the Germans would have been able to establish a beachhead in southern England, but that the Royal Navy would have soon severed their sea lines of communication. The war games assessed that, once isolated, the trapped German troops in England would have surrendered within just 4 days. Little regard was given to the ability of the Luftwaffe to mount aerial resupply missions, or the fact that trapped German formations in places such as Stalingrad, Demyansk, and Korsun demonstrated a marked ability to fight on for weeks or months on minimal supplies. Unlike the Russian front, German troops in England would not be freezing to death or surrounded by an enemy with vastly superior numbers. In North Africa, even when Rommel's Deutsche Afrika Korps, DAK, troops were short on fuel and ammunition, they were repeatedly able to repulse British infantry and armor attacks. The idea that German forces in England would simply surrender because a number of supply ships had been sunk is preposterous and without any basis in wartime fact. The German soldier of the World War II repeatedly demonstrated an ability to fight through adversity, not wilting because of supply disruptions. Equally invalid is the commonly held fantasy about the British Army's ability to contain and quickly eliminate any German lodgment. British assessments of Sea Lion's prospects stressed that the British Army had recovered considerably by September 1940 and was capable of fighting on equal terms with German ground forces. It was reckoned that 30 British divisions ought to be able to defeat the 10 German divisions in Sea Lion's first wave. Yet, sober analysis of ground combat between German and British units in the period 1940 to 1943 indicates a significant disparity in tactical competence between the two opponents. In North Africa, German ground forces were often at a logistical disadvantage, but still managed to best their British opponents through superior leadership and tactics. While British troops demonstrated considerable prowess on defense, their ability to conduct successful attacks against German units remained poor until after the 1944 Normandy campaign. The record of failure in numerous attacks, which have great bearing upon the British Army's ability to defeat a German invasion, is often conveniently swept under the rug. While it is true that British troops would likely have fought very hard to defend their own soil, this patriotic fervor would do little to ameliorate consistently weak tactical leadership and lack of tactical agility. It is not my intent to present a counterfactual or conjectural history of an operation that did not occur. That exercise has already been conducted by others. I also intend to be very restrained in the use of "if" as a qualifier. Rather, my intent is to demonstrate that history at critical moments often has options. It is not predetermined to proceed down the path that it actually did move along. Anyone familiar with military planning process is aware of branches and sequels that are developed to provide senior leaders with a variety of options to meet various circumstances. In the case of Sea Lion, Hitler was not preordained to cancel the operation because the Luftwaffe failed to break the RAF's fighter command. In fact, he continued to have the same strategic options after the Battle of Britain that he had before. Nor was Hitler preordained to eschew Seelöwe in favor of Barbarossa, and a well-planned invasion attempt in spring 1941 might well have been the decisive moment of the World War II. This is intended to be a complex historical narrative, premised on the idea that the outcome of significant historical events, like Germany's efforts to force Britain to the peace table in 1940 to 1941, were driven by multiple factors, and that there was no single explanation. Chapter 1. Strategic Setting. June to July, 1940. The Legacy of Dunkirk. Britain had not begun to prepare seriously for war until after the 1938 Munich crisis, and then most of the resources were devoted to the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy, not the Army. At the start of the World War II, Britain had 224,000 trained personnel in its regular army, which formed the bedrock of its ground combat capability. Although much of the Army's equipment was of World War I vintage, new weapons like the Bren light machine gun and the 2-pounder anti-tank gun were modernizing the regular infantry divisions. However, the regulars could never provide more than a fraction of the manpower needed for a European war, and Britain relied upon 173,000 regular army reservists and 200,000 personnel aligned with the Territorial Army, TA, to provide the necessary bulk. Yet both groups were virtually untrained. Conscription was enacted under the provisions of the National Services Act, which would enable the British Army to add another 600,000 personnel by spring 1940. In April 1939, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's cabinet approved a plan to outfit 32 divisions, 6 regular and 26 TA, by September 1941. The decision was made to double the size of the Territorial Army to over 400,000 men. In addition, several armored divisions would be formed, and all infantry divisions motorized. This ambitious plan envisioned increasing the size of the army tenfold, as well as equipping them with over 200,000 motor vehicles and 7,000 tanks. 4 days after the British declaration of war, First Sea Lord Winston Churchill vehemently argued to increase the army to 55 divisions, including 23 from the Commonwealth. But this suggestion was shelved. As it was, transforming over 1 million untrained recruits into an effective army of more than 30 divisions was a gargantuan task, and the War Ministry anticipated that 20 divisions would be ready by September 1940, and 12 more by September 1941. Chamberlain's army program made no provisions for enemy action or losses, and training of the second-tier TA units was deferred. Thus, when the German Blitzkrieg opened in the West on the 10th of May 1940, the timetable for the British Army's expansion plan was completely wrecked. Instead, Britain went to war with an army that was intended more to demonstrate diplomatic resolve rather than to engage in large-scale combat against a skilled opponent. Prior to the war, Chamberlain's cabinet planned to equip 10 divisions for continental deployment in the event of war. On the 4th of September 1939, the British Expeditionary Force, BEF, under Lord Gort, began arriving in France and initially consisted of two corps, 1st and 2nd, each comprising 2 regular infantry divisions, 1, 2, 3, 4. In December 1939, a 5th Regular Infantry Division was sent to France, followed by 5 TA divisions, 42, 44, 48, 50, 51, in January to April 1940. In late April, 3 second-line divisions, 12, 23, 46, were also sent to France, as well as the incomplete 1st Armored Division. By May 1940, the BEF, on paper, consisted of 394,165 troops in 13 infantry and 1 armored division. However, only the 5 regular infantry divisions were adequately trained and equipped, even though civilian vehicles were still being used until sufficient military lorries became available. The newly raised TA divisions were much further behind, and the equipment they were provided was obsolescent. Particularly egregious was the dearth of tactical radios at brigade level and below, which made command or control of mobile operations problematic. British training was also highly deficient in a number of regards, being still primarily geared towards 1918-style tactics and unconcerned with the possibility of air attack. British armored units were far from combat ready, with a mix of poorly designed tank types and saddled with an incoherent doctrine. Optimistically, the British leadership hoped that the much larger French army, which had 74 divisions facing Germany, would conduct the bulk of any ground operations until the BEF was fully trained and equipped. On the 18th of December, 1939, the lead elements of the 1st Canadian Infantry Division arrived at Aldershot, in England, the first major Commonwealth contribution to the British war effort. Prior to the war, Canada had a tiny regular army of only 4,500 personnel, backed by a 10,000-man militia. But the decision was made to send troops to Great Britain as soon as possible. The Canadian soldiers arrived without steel helmets, equipped with worn-out Lewis guns and 18-pounder artillery pieces. Britain would have to outfit them with virtually all their equipment, adding to the delay of outfitting the TA divisions. Furthermore, three-quarters of the Canadians were untrained recruits. By March 1940, the Canadian 1st Infantry Division grew to a 23,000-man force, and a 2nd Division was being readied in Canada. Australia also promised to send a corps with two infantry divisions to join the BEF in France, and New Zealand promised one division. But most of these troops were still training in Palestine or en route when France capitulated. When the German Western Offensive began on the 10th of May, most of the BEF moved into Belgium, along with the best French divisions, intending to block any German turning movement into northern France, as had occurred in 1914. On the same day, Winston Churchill succeeded Neville Chamberlain as Prime Minister. Yet the German invasion of Belgium was not the main effort. That came further south, at Sedan, where Generaloberst Heinz Guderian's panzers from the 19th Armée Corps, motorized, smashed through second-rate French divisions and quickly achieved a major breakthrough. Guderian's panzers advanced westward to the coast, and as fate would have it, the only Allied formation in their path was the 12th Infantry Division, a second-line TA formation assigned to protect the BEF's lines of communications into Belgium. On the 20th of May, all three of Guderian's Panzerdivisionen overran the dispersed British territorials, completely demolishing the division. Its battalions suffered 80% losses, and the division was permanently disbanded. With that minor obstacle removed, the 2nd Panzer Division reached the English Channel near Abbeville and pivoted northward. Lord Gort's BEF and three French armies were now isolated. For a few days, the Allies attempted to mount a counteroffensive to reopen land communications to the south. But these efforts failed. As France wilted under the German onslaught, Churchill made a number of hasty decisions. He quickly realized that the BEF was in serious danger, and that possession of the Channel ports was crucial to sustaining or evacuating Lord Gort's forces. The Royal Navy was already beginning to plan for an evacuation of the BEF, designated Operation Dynamo. But the Channel ports needed to be secured from Guderian's panzers, sweeping in from the south. In order to demonstrate British resolve, Churchill ordered British units sent to reinforce the French garrisons in the vital ports of Calais and Boulogne. On the morning of the 21st of May, Colonel William Fox Pitt's 20th Guards Brigade was dispatched from England by sea to Boulogne, where two battalions arrived the next morning. Fox Pitt's brigade was sent so quickly that his soldiers arrived in France with only 50 rounds of rifle ammunition each, no grenades, no anti-tank mines, and no vehicles. Only 8 hours after the guardsmen began disembarking, the the vanguard of the 2nd Panzer Division reached the outskirts of the city.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?